This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, March 27th, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. On this edition of Ozarks, food. We'll visit a farm in Carroll County growing food with techniques developed more than 100 years ago. We'll take a tour into the forest searching for wild food. And we have a preview of what will be available when the Fayetteville Farmers Market opens in less than 2 weeks.
But first, a new facility on the University of Arkansas campus that is designed to help fill the demand for nurses in the state. Yesterday, the university officially opened the Epley Center for Health Professions. The center is the home of the University of Arkansas Speech and Hearing Clinic and the Eleanor Mann School of Nursing. Both programs offered in the College of Education and Health Professions. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas was there.
I think that if any of us have a health crisis today, we're covered.
Tom Smith, Dean of the College of Education and Health Professions, began yesterday's event joking about the number of health professionals and students that were gathered at the Epley Building for Health Professions. He called the day historic and truly wonderful. He welcomed notable members of the community, U of A President Don Bobbitt, as well as Board of Trustees member Mark Waldrip, and former Representative John Paul Hammerschmidt, among others, before introducing the building itself.
It's the new home of the Speech and Hearing Clinic, where our students studying communication disorders gain valuable clinical experience while serving people of all ages in the community. And it's also the home of the Eleanor Mann School of Nursing, where we prepare bachelor's and master's degree students in the field of nursing.
The building sits on the location of the former Richardson Student Health Center. Members of Dr. Richardson's family were also in attendance.
A portion of the former building was salvaged. A new historic building plaque has been placed at the entrance of the Speech and Hearing Clinic honoring this family.
The new facility is separated into two sides. On one, the Speech and Hearing Clinic. This move has enabled the clinic to expand its services to include treatment for children. New rooms include individual and group therapy rooms for adults and children, as well as a family assessment room. The nursing side also contains the most up-to-date facilities.
It has 5 high-fidelity simulation labs in which mannequins simulate patient conditions and offer scenarios for nursing students to address. The mannequins can breathe, they have a pulse, their pupils dilate, and they can respond to questions from students about their pain level after the student has administered medication. These mannequins are simply amazing tools. They work in conjunction with 5 debriefing rooms in which students and faculty can view footage from the sim labs to assess and critique the student's performance.
Chancellor David Gerhardt mentioned gifts from Steve and Paula Milstein and Washington Regional Medical Center. In addition to those, former school teacher and longtime benefactor to the U of A, Peggy Parks, honored her mother, Amelia Murphy, with a gift to support the Amelia Rims Murphy RN Nursing Learning Environment. Ms. Parks introduced the crowd to her mother, a nurse during World War I and the following flu pandemic.
That my mother often worked 2 shifts and then spent the night at the hospital so she could remain on call. Now, with a shortage of nurses in our country, I was surprised to find that the university had to turn away students who wanted to go into nursing because there was a shortage of money, books, space, and teachers.
The opening of this building has allowed the Eleanor Mann School of Nursing to double enrollment in order to help fill the demand for nurses. Also in attendance were Donna and Lewis Epley, for whom the Center for Health Professions is named. Mr. Epley recognized the 100 or so students in attendance, standing around the edges of the crowd in their red scrubs and white coats.
This building was constructed for the use of the students today and tomorrow to further their education. And I got out my student first lapel pin today, Chancellor, because we all need to remember that this is why we're here today. It is because of the students.
At the age of 17, Mr. Epley was diagnosed with polio. He traces his interest in health professions to the care that he received then. His wife, Donna, a registered nurse for over 30 years, helped Peggy Parks to cut the red ribbon stretched in front of the north entrance of the Epley Center for Health Professions. After the students called the hogs, the building opened to the public for tours. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
A hike through the Ozarks or Ouachitas takes you past more than just waterfalls, trees, and bluffs. You could be passing by a veritable salad bar, if you know what you're doing. You can even find edible vegetation in the middle of a city park, as Ozarks at Large's Meredith Martin Moats recently discovered.
This past Saturday, Elevate Arkansas, an urban community wellness center, hosted its first walk in its spring-long wild plant and edible foraging series. Touted as a way to find free, organic, and vitamin-rich food growing in your own backyard, the walk took place at Little Rock's Alsop Park, where about 15 people showed up, including a few children. It was an unseasonably warm and sunny day, and the park was filled with children running, dogs sniffing, a group of masons holding a baseball tournament, and several mountain bikers on their way to the bike trails. Before heading into the more wooded areas, we met by the tennis courts near the creek, where many of the adults were armed with notebooks and iPhones in hand, ready to document information about each of the plants. Elevate director Jeff Dempsey began the walk by asking everyone to take a look at the books they had on hand, a necessary resource, he said, for both beginner and veteran foragers alike.
There's so many plants that are edible that I stick to the ones that I know, but, you know, I'll branch out when I find a new one or whatever, but I'll just, you know, always just double check with, you know, at least a couple of references and make sure I know exactly what it is. But with that, I think we're ready to start walking. Let's get into it. And if any of you guys want to just take one of these books with you, if you got an extra hand and whatnot, you're welcome to. But other than that, let's get walking.
With Jeff leading the way, we headed toward the stream, pillowy pockets of clover underfoot.
First thing I'll show you guys, it's the easiest thing everybody knows, is clover. Okay, and it's edible. You can pick the leaves and put them into a salad. You can pick the flowers and put them in a salad. Or you can, sometimes what we'll do if we find a lot of the flowers is actually like fritter them and fry them up. And you can do that with dandelions too. If there's just a bajillion dandelions, pick them all and batter them and throw them into a little oil and saute them, and they're really good that way. So clover, it grows everywhere. Let's take a walk over here. You see a lot of this pretty much all over Arkansas. This is just a wild chive or wild onion. So you can chop that up and put it in your salad. It tastes just like chives, just like onions or onion leaves.
One of my favorites of the day was henbit. I can almost promise you that it's growing somewhere near your house, probably right next to the clover. A member of the mint family, it has square-like leaves and is currently in its flowering stage, dotted with tiny lavender blooms.
We're going to find a bit more of this as we go. This grows everywhere in Arkansas, and that is henbit. It's a little bit hairy and, you know, kind of...
Say it again?
Henbit.
Henbit.
Mm-hmm. And it actually has like a square stem, so related to mint. It doesn't taste minty at all. It tastes kind of like a mushroom or something.
We walked on, still in a rather populated area of the park. Dempsey noted that it's best not to forage in these traveled areas due to all the foot traffic. And even though many plants won't grow along heavily traveled paths, you can still find some of the hardiest versions next to parking lots and trails.
This right here is plantain, and it's a very nutritious herb. I was telling some folks on the table that you can actually crush it up. You have like a mosquito bite or something like that, or a cut, you can crush it up and use it as like a poultice. It's got these prominent veins on it, and there are several different types of this. What I like to do with like this, because it grows all over my yard, and so does dandelion, is I'll pick this and you know, get a good handful of it and blend up like bananas and peaches or blueberries and just any kind of fruits, and then throw that handful in there, and then you got like boom, and you got the powers needed.
It seemed like
yeah.
This.
Okay, good. So this is Doug has just found some curly dock. Okay, and Curly Dock is like a not the greatest tasting plant, and it can grow really big. Like these leaves, I mean, they could be like this big after a while. And you want to make sure if you're going to eat them, especially if you're going to eat them raw, just pick the little leaves on there.
As we headed up to the more wooded areas, we picked peppergrass and tasted the edible flowers from a redwood tree. Up into the rockier terrain of the mountain bike trail, we found one of my personal favorites, the tart and punchy wood sorrel.
And this variety has like a purple underside on the leaf. And it's also got that kind of purpley thing on the top that makes it look like a clover. And it looks a whole lot like a clover except for...
As we walk through some of the shadier and fern-filled areas, we sampled shoots of the greenbrier plant, which tasted much like fresh green beans, and sampled some wintercress, a plant similar to watercress, which also grows wild. Some of the plants were plentiful, others were just beginning to peek out behind the fallen dead leaves scattered along the ground. And while most of the walk was focused on adding some free, nutrition-loaded plants to meals and smoothies, there was some discussion of survival eating.
So everybody knows about pine trees. They're everywhere, but maybe you didn't know that you can actually eat the pine needles, but you can eat, like, if they have little bitty shoots on the end, that's what you want to eat, the tender. And then also if you're, like, in a survival situation, there's pine trees around, you can take the inner bark, you can scrape it off, and you can make it into a flower.
There will be several other plant walks taking place throughout the spring and summer. The next one will be on April 7th. For more information, visit Elevate Arkansas at elevatearkansas.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Meredith Martin-Moots.
This is Ozarks at Large. Foundation Farm in northern Carroll County uses a novel type of system called no-till. Developed in the mid-20th century, no-till farming is similar to how nature grows wild foods. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich met with farmer Patrice Gross during last week's spring monsoon. They took shelter until the rain abated in a greenhouse complex to talk about the logic and method of no-till agriculture over cups of hot jasmine tea.
Thank you. Good hot tea on a wet, drizzly... Are you getting enough rain for your farm beds?
Yes, thank you. You know, 3-4 inches yesterday and more today. That's about the threshold where I start to get a little bit upset about water. Usually, you know, you try not to be because water is so great otherwise.
You don't have plows here?
No plows, no tiller, no machine. There's one machine we still have, which I can't get rid of, and that's the mower. I do it a lot like nature does it. I use layers of organic matter that feeds, not only protects my soil the way nature protects soil, but it also feeds my microorganism in the soil. And for that, I use mostly wheat in the form of straw. So I use wheat straw.
Every farmer has to use pesticides and herbicides and soil amendments, nutrients, fertilizers, compost. So talk about what no-till farms don't require and do require in that respect.
Yes, we do require the main ingredient, as I mentioned, is the use of organic matter. And that comes mostly in the form of the mulch itself, the straw that I use on the beds. But also I use rabbit manure, you know, once a year. That's part of the formula. But beside those two things, which are very, very small in terms of the total input, I don't require anything else. And the reason is that the microorganism in a no-till soil mine all the nutrients for me. They go to work, you know, for me. And as long as the soil has all these resources, the microorganism will do the job, will do the work for me. So it's an amazing, now bear that, bear, think about this. Because I don't need so many requirements, so many inputs, that makes my farming incredibly profitable. My profit margins are double that of a regular farm.
You've not tilled for 7 years, so what's the soil like? Where typically in the Ozarks here, wherever you put a shovel, you encounter clay and rock.
Well, in my soil, if you ever experience quicksand, if you take a shovel, it actually swallows your arm. In some situation when it really is perfect, but it only gets better year after year because there's such an amazing amount of micro life at work. So many worms. Right now we're planting cabbage that every time we put that trowel to put that tiny plant, we actually stand to kill 3 or 4 worms. It's insane. I mean, it's actually, you know, to the point where we have an issue with what can we do, and we set aside the worms. I mean, it's crazy.
But the wonderful thing about the worms that do survive the carnage is that they have vermiculture. So describe the castings from worms as an incredibly rich nutrient for the soil.
Yes, it is part of the system. So we have worms doing their work and everything else in between bacteria and, you know, we have the whole world of nature at work, including, you know, we also have mice and all kinds of other creatures that are part of the system. You know, I have frogs that are constantly around the beds at night in summer. That are part of the system too, and they just all of that tame the possibility of insect breakouts. It's amazing the amount of balance. You know what people don't realize: once you put together this natural system, you actually get really close to what nature was intended to do, and there is an amazing balance that gets created that allows me to not have any or many insect or disease issues.
So what crops do you grow here and what are your yields like?
Well, I'm a typical truck farmer. I try to grow everything that people will buy from a table at a farmer's market. I have my preferences. I know my sort of favorite kids in the class, you know, peppers, and I love growing tomatoes, lettuce, basil. So it's kind of across the board. I don't know if I can make any sense of all that, but the yields are usually, well, I measure my yields in terms of dollar per square foot. And on half an acre of bed surface, I can grow about $50,000 worth of food. So that's basically, you know, like a real simple number to remember is my yields are equivalent to $100,000 an acre. Which, you know, I'm not the only guy to do that. There's a few, but it takes that kind of intensive approach to farming. And what I'm glad to say is that no-till can match the very best tilled organic farms in the country. With this system, you actually do less. You work less. And my proof there is that I do all this work. I raise my family. This is my only job, but only work 3 mornings a week, which might upset some farmers. Some people actually, I've had people just tell me I was a liar. So I say, well, just come and hide in the bushes.
You've had record heat all last summer. 3 months of 100-degree heat practically. Tremendous rains both last spring and now this spring. A no-till garden is, how does a no-till farm behave in these conditions?
It can absorb as much at twice as much water as a tilled soil. The organic matter content is part of that. The more organic matter content in the soil and the more absorption and retention of water it can hold. It's amazing to face. It has an amazing ability to face heat and dry weather in summer.
One study published several years ago in the journal Soil Science Society of America found that no-till soil tends to store more carbon, which aids in carbon sequestration and is more stable. Despite flooding rains, Foundation Farms fields were not saturated. We walk along narrow carpets of green fescue planted in between row crops.
As you can see, there is a perfect succession of bed and path. And the path are beautiful, green. They're easy to actually access the beds with, and there's never any mud in my system, and my vegetable are always clean.
But trees pushes a trowel effortlessly into a bed of kale, bringing up a black chunk of soil teeming with earthworms.
An amazing amount of decaying roots. You can see it looks exactly, of course, earthworms is here, but it looks like a crumbly chocolate cake. And that is impossible to have if you till your soil. When you till your soil, what you get is a powdery effect, not crumbly, because what I'm holding is billions and billions of organisms, bacteria and fungi and who knows what else.
And who knows what else?
Well, I sort of know, but it's out there. The science is really good on this, okay? By the way, it's starting to become really good. A lot of people are studying this. Getting into my mode of I'm getting the
weeding. Yeah. Couldn't help it. Now you're starting to weed. Oh, you're getting back to work.
Okay.
Well, Patrice, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was fun. Thank you, Jackie. It's always a pleasure to have you on the farm.
Foundation Farms' Patrice Gross talking with Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich about his no-till farm in northern Carroll County. He sells his certified organic produce to area restaurants as well as at the Eureka Springs and Fayetteville farmers markets. To learn more, visit foundationfarm.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. Students of the University of Arkansas system could face tuition increases of up to 5% next year. The University of Arkansas released projected figures yesterday. The increases may present a hurdle to the goal of doubling the amount of college graduates by 2025. But University of Arkansas system spokesperson Ben Beaumont says the increases are not as bad as they could have been.
Arkansas has been fortunate not to face the state budget cuts to the level of other states. We've been able to keep a decent amount of state revenue. Tuition hasn't had to make up the funding gap. But we know that state budgets are tight, and we know we have to do more with less. And we believe these proposals are in line with that.
Ben Beaumont says committees of students, faculty, teachers, and parents decided on the increases for their respective campuses. The UA Board of Trustees will consider the figures in meetings later this week.
A new poll of more than 700 likely Arkansas voters shows President Obama is not making any headway in the state. Roby Brock is with Talk Business, which conducted the survey last night along with Hendricks College.
He is sitting at about 32% approval versus 63.5% disapprove. Those numbers come pretty close to tracking where he was last September. So despite, capturing and killing Osama bin Laden, the economy improving in some particular areas, it does not seem to be changing Arkansans' views of the job performance of Obama.
If the president is put head-to-head with GOP frontrunner Mitt Romney, the Republican would win 56% to 33%, while 10% said they didn't know. Key in the November election will be who independents vote for. That's a big problem spot for President Obama in Arkansas, where independents disapprove of his job performance by a 3-to-1 margin.
Speaking of presidential hopefuls, Republican presidential hopeful Rick Santorum is scheduled to be in Benton County this spring. The Benton County Republican Party Lincoln Day Dinner will host the former Pennsylvania senator. It will take place at the John Q. Hammond Center in Rogers on May 4th. Tickets are to be available soon. Yesterday, the NCAA announced the participating teams in the NCAA South Central Gymnastics Regional that will take place April 7th in Barnhill Arena on the University of Arkansas campus. UCLA, the 2010 National Championship squad, will be the number one seed at the regional. Arkansas, ranked in the top 10 almost all of the season, will be the number two seed. Other teams invited: Boise State, Missouri, New Hampshire, and Maryland. The teams with the top two scores at each regional will then go to the national championships.
Stormwater runoff is a major pollutant in water today. Rain gardens can help. The Beaver Water District and IRWP will hold a Rain Garden Academy on Thursday, April 5th at 9 a.m. at the Fayetteville Town Center. You can make a difference in the quality of your water. Registration and more information available at irwp.org or 215-6623.
It is Tuesday, March 27th, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
With us is Becca Bacon-Martin. She's features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
There is so much to choose from tonight. Good luck.
Let's go.
That's all I got to say.
All right.
There's an author talk with Jeannie Wayne, the author of Delta Empire.
I've read that book. It was fantastic.
Fascinating.
Fantastic.
3 o'clock at the Bella Vista Library. There's a fiction book club meeting tonight at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville. The topic is The Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes. That happens at 5:30.
Okay.
At 6 o'clock, the students, the drama students, and Warren Rosenauer are going to say goodbye to the Fayetteville High School Theater.
Yeah, the gymnasium's gone.
Yeah.
And so the theater is about to meet the wrecking ball.
They're going to have highlights from the last year, a tribute to seniors, acting awards, and they're going to start a new tradition because he's always let them sign the wall.
Yeah.
And now they're going to sign a senior flat that they can take with them to the new performance space.
So does that mean those walls that have been signed for years are
gone?
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's what happens to walls.
Yeah. But that happens at 6 o'clock. And there's an author talk with Eric Litwin. He is the words of Pete the Cat, I Love My White Shoes.
Right.
I didn't know his name because what I know is James Dean, the artist who draws Pete the Cat, whose work I fell in love with in New Orleans, who's been to Eureka Springs several times for art signings. Eric Litwin is the author of The Words. He's going to speak tonight at 6:30 at the Bentonville Public Library. And I'll bet you that if you took your books that you already have signed by James Dean, oh, like some of us do, you could probably get him to sign them too. And Ozark Poets and Writers Collective meets at 7 o'clock tonight with Gerald Sloan.
Yes.
Who has a new book of poetry called Paper Lanterns. That's at Nightbird Books.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
With us, Teresa Maurer, a local food advocate who has been here many times before. Welcome back.
Ah, it's great to be back.
It's spring.
It is spring, almost feeling like summer. I want to kind of put the brakes on it for some reasons and keep it going for other reasons. But
well, what do earlier days than expected in the 80s mean for farmers?
Well, it means the timelines are moving up. Our market opens on April the 7th here in Fayetteville. The other markets open at different times. And I've had calls from people saying, well, when does the market open? And calls from farmers saying, do you have anything like sooner than the market opening? So there are things that are a couple of weeks early. And, they want outlets and places to sell those. So we're going to try to think for future years about what kind of flexibility we could introduce in.
What happens when they do have these things that they need to get rid of, but they don't have a place to get rid of? I mean, can you freeze these things? I'm no good with food. I'm just going to tell you right now.
Well, there are probably some things, and there are some of our farmers that participate in what's called the winter market. That's an online ordering. So maybe some of them can publicize through that,
okay.
And that's where you order ahead and then pick up. But most of the time, it's kind of picking up the phone and seeing, who could use it. Chefs around town have gotten a lot more interested in local food. So,
what are some of the foods that are coming up earlier than expected?
Well, I think the asparagus is early. I think we've got a wider variety of greens than we might normally have this time of year. We've got leeks that are pretty good size. We've got flowers. There's going to be a little – I'm a little worried about exactly what's going to show up in terms of flowers because some things are past that would normally just be coming in.
The tulips
but
were very, very early this
very
year.
Very early, right. But the good thing is that most of our flower vendors have a great diversity, and they're going to be putting together bouquets. And, again, there might be a little more diversity in those bouquets than you might expect normally this time of year. But that's a good thing, especially right before – Easter and the other holidays this time of year.
So if you have leeks and asparagus coming up before you expected, does that mean they'll go away earlier?
I would say on the asparagus, possibly yes. They might go away earlier. But it depends on the bed and it depends on your mulching and it depends on, sort of what really happens. But asparagus it's got a a short season in terms of other things, but it should last for several weeks no matter what. But I would suggest for those things that are kind of high demand, like asparagus and other things, get there early. Get your shopping done early. That 7 to 9 slot's really nice. And then 9:30, things will start, you know, picking up. Although with the first day at the market, it could be busy just from start to finish.
But there's something happening before the market, right?
Yes, there are. This is a local food event as part of the Fayetteville Forward kind of effort, looking at lots of different things that contribute to sustainability in our community. I was asked to facilitate a special discussion, open to anybody, a discussion on local food, what's going on, what else could we do, steering people towards efforts in the area. And that's going to happen on April 5th, which is a Thursday from 10 till noon in the East Square building, just at the edge of the square. They're going to open that whole bottom part, so there will be things on transportation and green infrastructure, green economy. There'll be other discussion groups going on, but I'll be hosting the one on local food.
And that's where the underground used to be, correct?
Yes, okay. Exactly. That's a really good building. Yeah, that's a really good landmark. And then later that day, I mean, there's First Thursday, of course. The 40 Days of Earth Day is starting. We have one other specific local food event, which is that Slow Food, Ozark Slow Food, the nonprofit that is working on supporting local food, is going to have a volunteer happy hour at the former location of the Brick House Kitchen Restaurant on South School Street. And that's from 5:30 to 7. And you can go to our website at ozarkslowfood.org to get the details on that. And that's open to anyone with the proviso that you agree to sign up to, whether you got an hour, whether you got half a day, to help with a local food event. And we'll have several of those up and available for sign up.
Will there be a 2012 edition of the Local Food Guide?
There will. And we had originally planned to print it up a little bit later, so it was released at the beginning of the summer. But we've been asked by the community to get it out by early May so that it could be available for Artisphere, for Michael Pollan's appearance at the Walton Arts Center, for First Thursday, First Friday, all those things. So what I was hoping I could tell you about is that a deadline that was going to be in April has been moved up to March 31st.
Oh, my.
Yes. So, but the good thing is we have a lot easier way for people to submit entries online. And what we're looking for are farmers, restaurants, grocers, various kinds of local food deliveries, you know, anything, anybody like that who would like to have a very short entry in this local food guide can go online to NWALocalfoodguide.org. It's NWALocalfoodguide.org.
The idea, again, with this is that it's a clearinghouse for people who want to know who sells, who prepares, who grows.
Exactly. Right. And we started out in 2011 with just a real short little guide, and we're going to grow it a little bit each year. Last year it was 8 pages. This year we're hoping to grow it to about 16 and add some color and some photos. And we've been getting some sponsorships that make that possible. And it's a 4-county area that the local food guide is covering. So, you know, Washington, Carroll, Madison, and Benton counties. So if you have a favorite farmer, or if you are a chef and you buy regularly from local farmers, or you are a grocer that specifically labels local food, that is something you can go and do. So it's really easy. It's just about 10 lines of information. You can fill it out online, hit submit, and that's it.
And the deadline is now this Saturday.
This Saturday, right.
Thank you, Teresa.
Thank you, Kyle.
Included in the early arrivals at the farmer's market is chard. Teresa shared a recipe for chard with us, and you can hear that audio extra at our website, ozarksatlarge.com.
Also at our webpage are links that connect you to local food resources.
So you think you know it all. How big did dinosaur fleas run? Foot long, an inch long, or the same size but really, really overworked?
Foot long. Big fleas.
Would it still be a flea at a foot, though? I mean, like, come on, let's talk about it.
Oh, no. Small?
No.
Stop doing that, man. That is very upsetting.
I think
join me this week on Michael Feldman's What Do You Know? From PRI, Public Radio International.
What Do You Know? Saturday morning at 10 on KUAF.
Creating a movie franchise can be an expensive exercise, and not one that always pays off. This month, John Carter, a fantasy movie based on a 100-year-old Edgar Rice Burroughs novel, flopped at the box office. But this past weekend, The Hunger Games flourished and seems ready to make millions, if not billions, of dollars over the next several years. Wayne Bell writes the column Culture Club for FayettevilleFlyer.com. He says, even with the financial disappointment connected to John Carter, do not count out the power of the movie franchise.
That doesn't seem to matter of late that they lose money. It's just there's such a lack of new ideas that...
Do you think even something that loses up to $200 million might have John Carter returns to Mars?
Or somebody will take it and redo it in a different way. So I guess it's not technically part of that franchise, but it doesn't seem to stop them from happening.
And the idea behind a good franchise can not just stabilize a studio, it can keep it in the black for some time. You think of the Harry Potter movies that made nearly $8 billion worldwide.
And that's true of a couple from recent, besides Harry Potter. You look at something like the Lord of the Rings series.
And just three movies, but very.
Three movies, made a ton of money and won a ton of Oscars. You have a more popular fare like Twilight that comes out every year, and you know it's going to be a big hit with that demographic. And then you have some others that have done fairly well, like the Ocean's 11 franchise. Yeah. You know, three movies that did pretty well at the box office. The Fast and Furious series, despite what you may think about it, it's done really well financially.
And then there are some series. When you suggest that we talk about movie franchises, I started looking up. There are some of these that just fly under most people's radar, but do well because they cost not that much to make. There have been 8 installments in the Amityville horror movie franchise. 8.
Right.
Who knew? I didn't know there was one more than 2.
Right. And that's one genre that, like Scream, you know, they come out and, you know, they do really well, particularly in the fall around Halloween. And then they go away and you forget about them. And then they come back a few years later. So... what people do tend to think about when they think about franchises is those big summer blockbusters like Iron Man or Pirates of the Caribbean or even...
Which is had 4.
Right. Now. Or even like, you know, Pixar Toy Story type thing. But it's really difficult to find an engaging franchise that will continue over time. Do you have some favorites?
I was thinking about this and I have 2. One is kind of a cheat, perhaps, and one is not. I think back... I'm going way back because franchises are not a new phenomenon.
No.
They existed in the silent days. I really enjoy the Frankenstein series that Universal made with Boris Karloff, and there were 8 of those. They ended in self-parody with Abbott and Costello, so they did decline.
Right.
So that's one that I think of. But the modern day, the Bourne series.
Right.
There were 3 Jason Bourne movies, and I think each was better than the previous one, and I really enjoyed those.
I mean, I think the classic one is probably The Godfather. Many people will argue that they feel like the second one was probably the best of the three.
And 3 is not...
Not that many people say that 3 is their favorite, but
it's not
they
as
will
bad.
Say it's commendable.
Yeah, it's not as bad as what the legend has built up around it, I think.
Right. It's not a bad movie. It's probably one of the best movies of that year. As compared to the other movies that are in the series, it's not that, you know, as good. But it is probably the standard. I would say that the one that I always find or that I'm looking forward to would be like the Batman franchise. Because what's happened is just about the time that a franchise starts to get stale, like the Tim Burton Batman, then we go in a different direction, which is the new Christopher Nolan, where the third one's coming out this summer.
And that will end that segment, right?
Right. And then you'd think no more Batman movies for 5 years, but somebody will drag it up. But they always... I particularly like this Christopher Nolan set, and I even like the Tim Burton set, because, they're well done. But to say, you know, bad franchises, there's lots of those.
Yeah, and I guess some of those, and as I started looking, and there are eight My Little Pony movies, and there are six or seven movies, The Land Beyond Time or whatever. Those are intended for a specific audience that's going to like them no matter what. Right.
Yeah, when I think bad ones where it just goes way off course, I would say like probably Pirates of the Caribbean. Yeah, I mean, some could argue. I don't know necessarily those newer three were horrible.
Let's say that.
Oh yeah, I was just gonna
at
say
least two of them were.
They're just nothing in the same league,
right?
You know, and then you have really poorly reviewed movies like, you know, the Hangover series that just continues to go on, and you know, you look at
it's only been two.
Yeah, continues to go on and on because you know it will. And you, the second Sex in the City. I mean, you look at last summer or last year, 2011, and 9 of the 10 top movies were sequels or beyond. So, you know, they continue to rehash these stories. And that's why something like a Godfather or a Batman or something that's told in a second movie or a third movie and it puts it in a new light. With the Godfather, they sort of went with the backstory and brought in the Robert De Niro character. The Batman, the new Christopher Nolan series, he brings out a new villain each time.
When you think of certain franchises, Batman, mm-hmm. Sherlock Holmes has had 4 or 5 over the course of the last 60 or 70 years.
Right.
You have these established characters that we go in with some bit of knowledge to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that helps a franchise.
Well, I also think one thing that really does help some of the ones that we've talked about that are successful is the fact that you could watch the individual movies as a standalone piece.
You don't have to worry that you missed the first one.
Right. Godfather 2.
Right.
Although it's wonderful to watch after Godfather 1. It's a good standalone piece. Lord of the Rings 3, oftentimes people think is the best one. That's a standalone piece, mm-hmm. as is, you know, The Dark Knight. So these ones that are kind of standalone pieces tend to work really well over time.
I guess the ultimate franchise then would be James Bond. That's been around decades. And
that comes up in a new retelling every time. But, you know, I do expect there's a lot of franchises still. There's more Twilight coming this year, and there's more Batman, and there's lots of every, you know, franchise it seems coming this year.
Do you have a franchise that you think was that was either popular with at the box office or with critics that you just never got?
I never got the whole Fast and the Furious thing. I never seen more than the first half hour of the first one, mm-hmm. and I've never understood how these movies make so much money. And I could say that really for quite a few of these action type movies. Even, you know, Spider-Man, it's being retold again this summer, not long after the last franchise
right.
ended, and it's being retold, and I never quite understood, you know, give us a little time to digest it.
But it comes back to your concept about no new ideas. I mean, the fact is, if you can put a Spider-Man movie out there, there's a character that has a Q rating. People know, 9 out of 10 people walking the street at least know who that character is. So you don't
right.
have to do as much selling.
And you can do that with Woody and Buzz from Toy Story
right.
or Indiana Jones or Batman or any
right.
of these. So it's
Transformers, I suppose.
Yeah, there's another
yeah.
one that, you know, a bit of a stinker, but you can do it because you know. And you know the international box office is going to be big.
Right. Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you.
Wayne Bell writes about franchise movies and so much more in the column Culture Club at the FayettevilleFlyer.com. Time to give away a couple of movie passes to any area Malco movie theater. You can see John Carter if you want. Hunger Games, which you saw.
I did see Hunger Games.
And you said it was not bad.
Wasn't bad.
Most of the reviews have been good.
Yeah.
Also, two more tickets to Straight No Chaser. They will be at the Fort Smith Convention Center on Tuesday, April 10th, which is, what, 2 weeks from today at 8 p.m. A cappella group that getting a lot of praise on their tour. Okay. Much of our show today about food.
Mm-hmm.
My trivia question today, I don't know if this counts as trivia. It does for me because I don't know anything about food or baking.
Well, neither do I. Okay. So
I learned this while watching the Food Channel this weekend.
Okay.
We're probably people are going to laugh that I didn't know this.
I probably don't know it either.
Okay. If you take molasses and you take white sugar and put them together, you have what?
Oh, God. If you know or you have a guess, give us a call at 800-522-5823. That's 800-522-KUAF.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 27th of March, 2012. It was on this day, 1851, a group of miners called the Mariposa Battalion entered the Yosemite Valley, hoping to drive out a tribe of Indians so they could do some mining there. They thought they named the valley after the Indian tribe they were trying to drive out, but they got the name wrong. The tribe was called the Awanichi people. Yosemite was the name given them by other tribes as an insult. It meant those who kill. It was on this day, 1915, the woman known as Typhoid Mary was put into quarantine in a cottage in the Bronx. Mary Mallon, she was about 40, working as a cook in New York City, and every household she worked at came down with typhoid fever. Typhoid was common on battlefields. It may have killed more than 200,000 soldiers during the Civil War, but it was rarely seen in the wealthy households where she worked. In 1906, a doctor named George Soper noticed this strange pattern of outbreaks in wealthy homes, interviewed the families, found that they had all hired the same cook, and he finally tracked her down. Mary Mallon did not take it well when he asked her to provide a stool sample. She threatened him with a meat cleaver. He called the police, had her arrested. A stool sample was taken from her by force, and they discovered typhoid bacteria in her gallbladder. She admitted that she never washed her hands when she was cooking. They kept her in quarantine. She was released. She changed her name. She took up cooking again. She spread disease and death in her wake until they finally caught up with her again on Long Island, imprisoned her in the Bronx for the rest of her life, and she died of pneumonia in 1938. It's the birthday of John O'Farrell, born in Oxfordshire, England, 1962. For many years, he was a writer for The Spitting Image, a British satirical puppet TV show. Author of a nonfiction book entitled An Utterly Exasperated History of Modern Britain or 60 Years of Making the Same Stupid Mistakes as Always. It's the birthday of the director and screenwriter Quentin Tarantino, born in Knoxville, 1963, raised in Los Angeles near the airport, high school dropout, worked in a big video store, watched movies all day, wrote screenplays. His first movie was Reservoir Dogs, 1992. 2 years later came his big hit, Pulp Fiction. Latest project, Django Unchained, currently in production, a Western set in the Deep South. And it's the birthday of Julia Alvarez, born New York City, 1950, grew up in the Dominican Republic, came back to New York when she was 10, author of books about being caught between two cultures. Her novel, How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents, came out in 1991. Also wrote a nonfiction book, Once Upon a Quinceañera, about the tradition of throwing elaborate 15th birthday parties for young Latina women. Here's a poem for today by Michael Ryan, entitled Contentment. Fragile, provisional, it comes unbidden as evening. The children on the block called in to dinner, that for tonight is plentiful, as if it had cost nothing, either in money or worry about money. Then evening deepens, and the street turns silent. There may be disasters, idling in driveways, and countless distresses sharpening, But all that matters most, that must be done, is done. Contentment, a poem by Michael Ryan from his collection This Morning, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Constant Contact, now offering social campaigns, a new tool designed to help small businesses turn fans into customers. Learn more at constantcontact.com. Written by Holly Vanderhaar, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
All right, time to answer our question. Again, we're giving away a pair of passes to any area Malco movie theater. Also, two more tickets to see Straight No Chaser 2 weeks from tonight at the Fort Smith Convention Center. That's April 10th at 8 p.m. A cappella, a band of a cappella. I guess not a – well, you could be a group of a cappella singers.
A group of a cappella, yes.
Okay. So my question was – I learned this from the Barefoot Contessa, which my wife loves. She loves watching this show. If you take molasses and white sugar, it creates what?
Okay, I'm just going to start guessing sticky things that I know about. So, like corn syrup? Wait, that doesn't make sense. Corn syrup? No.
No.
Honey?
No.
I got nothing. I'm out.
Brown sugar. Brown sugar is basically
what?
White sugar mixed with molasses. I thought brown sugar was a naturally occurring different kind of sugar.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there you go.
Okay. We will never bake you anything
with
don't
brown sugar. Right.
No.
All right.
No.
We're going to pick a winner in a moment, and then we'll give you a call.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Sunset.
Where is Sunset?
It is east of Winslow.
East of Winslow. We may be there this afternoon.
I know.
We are going to be working on a hiking story.
Yes.
With our friend and guide, Robert Ginsburg, who, of course, is the host of KUAF show Shades of Jazz, but also quite an outdoors person.
I hope he's our guide because I know you or I.
No, we'll be lost without him. Literally, we'll be lost without him. But that's a program, that's a story that'll air sometime, I guess, next week. Tomorrow, by the way, on the program, Michael Jonathan, who is the host of the public radio show Wood Songs and will be at the auditorium Eureka Springs Thursday night, will join me from on the phone from his home in Kentucky, and we'll talk about his show coming up in his latest CD.
Excellent.
All right.
Brackets?
Yes.
Oh, Lord.
We have a KUAF, or not a K, but a Noz Arcs at Large wide bracket contest, as many people do. How are we doing? You're
well,
keeping score of this.
Yeah, I'm trying. Okay, so in the NCAA men's bracket, I think you're kind of winning based on the fact that you have two of the four Final Four.
Okay, so I had Kentucky
and
Kansas.
Yeah.
And everyone picked Kentucky to win.
Yes. Ithene and I still have Kentucky, so maybe I'm rooting for Kansas to lose. I'm not sure how I feel about this.
The fact that I have two of the Final Four and you guys have one pretty much seals that deal.
Does it?
I think
I'm
so
terrible with the point system and whatnot.
We also picked the women's bracket.
We did. And yours and I are pretty similar. We've got Baylor and UConn in the final. Mm-hmm. But I think what we decided before we started recording was that, let's see, you have Maryland beating
I have Maryland,
Notre Dame.
Right, in the Final Four, and you have Notre Dame.
I have Notre Dame, so probably based on that one.
That will determine who wins that.
Yeah.
We also picked the NIT brackets because somebody should.
Because somebody should. I'm still in the men's one because I have picked Stanford to win. You were done a long time ago.
Yeah. No. Never said I was good at this.
Well, no, and we didn't do any research, so, you know, that's fine. And then the women's, we're just both out. It's just I had Villanova, you had NC State, and for those of you keeping up, you know that they lost.
Yes, for those of you keeping up with the women's NIT tournament.
So it's all in good fun.
So we'll know who has won by early next week.
Yes.
And who will be who will have bragging rights for the rest of 2012. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
We will be back tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And don't forget the KUAF fundraiser begins Friday. And our goal is $150,000. So come Friday, call early, call often.
Yes, please.
And support your public radio station.
Thank you guys so much.
Have a great Tuesday.